The title, Can We Begin Again, I thought, came from a song in Jesus Christ Superstar. So here's what I thought, but as I was listening to the CD, I couldn't find it, so it may have come from Godspell, but I'm not sure where. What I had intended with that was after the followers of Jesus saw what was going on and began to understand the grief about what was happening, there was this song, Can We Begin Again? Can We Start Again? And as I have been thinking about who we are as a group of people and our principles and what's happening in our culture and what's happening to the earth, that song kept coming to me, Can We Begin Again? And I'm not even sure exactly what I meant by that, but looking at the St. Lucie River and looking at the rivers, sometimes I do wonder, could we begin again and somehow have boundaries so that it wouldn't be legal and normalized to pollute our environment, or legal and normalized to be harmful to other people? I was watching a Senate subcommittee on families and family practices, it's 2 days ago. And it's interesting, when I watched the Senate subcommittee on oil and all the oil executives were there, there were, I think, 10 white men sitting in a row, not needing to be sworn in for their testimony, because the group of white men that were, the senators that were interrogating, I guess might be the wrong word, talking to these people, the chairperson said, we don't have to swear them in. But there was this woman who's saying, no, they need to be sworn in. I think it was Diane Feinstein. No, they have to be sworn in. And the chairperson, Ted Stevens from Alaska, was saying, no, we're not swearing them in. I'm the chairperson, so there it is. We're not swearing them in. And it was this big fight, you know. And so it was this, a lot of energy and a lot of activity. And in the background, it was just all these people in the background. So that was big oil. So now we're at this subcommittee for family practices. And there were six women and one man being interviewed, and the two senators and maybe three or four people in the background, and that was it. That was it. And so I'm thinking, is there a message just in the setting itself? Just in the content, is there a message? And it was interesting, the man who was being testifying as a witness and was from the Heritage Foundation, and after he would speak, what was her name? She's from New York, University of New York. Gorgon, I believe her name was. Every time he would say something, she would say, and I would have to disagree, and here's the statistics disagreeing. And I thought, what is that about? And I was agreeing with what she was saying, and she was saying there was a need for child care, and there was a need for benefits, and there was a need for health. And as we've studied other countries, when we study these activities, it really doesn't lead to a lack of production or a reduction or harm the economy in any way. And so the senator, a gentleman by the name of Saxton, he said, you know, all that's well and good that men get maternity leave and women get good maternity leave and they get paid and all this is well and good, but we would see how it affects the economy. And I thought, what? These people are describing what psychological and spiritual health means, the conditions for psychological and spiritual health for the families of this country. That's what these women were describing. And the people in power were describing a value system that subordinates that to an economic structure.
You know, and I always kind of knew it, but I just never seen it so blatant right there in my face.
So can we begin again? It comes to me. And that story, I think, is a foundation to what I want to say and to what I want to get to. And before I move on, I do want to say the spaghetti dinner is a communion. Is it not? For the spaghetti monster? No, spaghetti god? Or what? glass of wine. So it's an invitation to come to share and have communion with one another, and it's a high religious event. And if you haven't been to a high religious event, our spaghetti dinners are a high religious event. So we want you to come participate in that. I also need a volunteer to read 10 books. So I need a volunteer for that. Because I've seen the light, and I'm only up here part-time, so I'm going to need somebody up here reading these books that I'm reading, so you can be the light up here during the week. And when I was moving from Southern Baptist to eventually Unitarian Universalist and getting involved in Unitarian Universalism, one of the part of that transition is that you need to read a book list. And the reason you need to read a book list is you need to master a particular body of knowledge. And that's why you read this book list in some theory, if you read it, and then you get interviewed and talked about it, see if you've integrated it, and you can make it your own, and it becomes part of you, and all that good stuff, then it would be deemed that you have mastered a body of knowledge. And that's no easy thing to do, to master a body of knowledge, because you're trying to integrate new thought into your imaginative process, into the structure of who you are, which is, in my case, five decades old of being structured, of being worked, and being honed to what I have some sense of integrity and some sense of understanding and respect, and some sense that I have some awareness of pieces or something about truth. Don't be too arrogant to say that I knew some truth, but something about it, or at least how to engage the world. But when you learn a body of knowledge, another group of thoughts, you have to integrate that into who you are and what you are, which is no easy chore. There's this author who describes our culture and describes us from 10,000 years ago, the agrarian age, prior to that, and what's happened up here. And he has this thing that he calls the Great Forgetting. And the Great Forgetting was who we were as human beings before we began to be organized through an economic structure that favored some and not others. The Great Forgetting. So these 10 books are about the Great Remembering. And they're about how to live in an economic and in a society and in the social fabric where if a group of people would say, we've got some difficulties with our families and they're struggling, and these are some of the answers that we think and some of the things we need to do in order to bring health back to our families, the leadership would say, well, of course, how can we facilitate that? The Great Forgetting results in somebody saying, we don't care about that, we need to pay attention to the economic system. The Great Remembering is a movement back to the place where those in leadership would say, of course, we would facilitate what's healthy for the families in our community and in our village. And I want to say, I have seen the light. I have seen the light. I have seen the light.
Right.
Many of you know I struggle in the darkness. I struggle in the darkness. I struggle. And here's examples of struggling in the darkness, if you haven't read this. When Society Becomes an Addict. Very good book. Talk to Society Becomes. Remember when George Bush said we were addicts? Remember that? I'm still looking for the 12-step group he's going to promote because he finally broke through his denial. I haven't seen the 12-step group, but usually when you're recovering from addictions and you admit you're an addict, there's some follow-up. There's not a continuation of the same behavior, or we question the actual sense of breaking through the denial. Well, look at this. The War on the Middle Class. Very good book. I mean, when you read this, you're going to be struggling in the darkness. I don't know if you know Eric Fromm, Escape from Freedom. What a title, Escape from Freedom. Very good that you're going to struggle in the darkness. From the same author as this one, Escape from intimacy. I don't know if she reads Fromm's books and then goes and gets her titles, but escape from intimacy. How many of you have any sense of understanding of the escape from intimacy? How many of you ever felt really close to somebody and said, that's it, I'm not going there anymore? How many of you have ever been in a relationship and the relationship ended and it was so painful, you made an absolute commitment you were never going to love that way again? Because if you love that way again, you could experience that pain again. But working through that pain is where deep intimacy is. So every time you get close to it, rather than risk the pain, you leave, you escape from intimacy. Another one here, Age of Anxiety, from Joe McCarthy. Another one, Struggle in the Darkness. Look at this one, The War on Truth. You will be in the darkness, you read this one. Failed State, Known Child, The Minimal Self, and so on and so on. There is something wrong in our culture. And each of these books are a distraction from the core issue, I believe, of what's wrong in our culture. They're important, and I can get lost in them. I can start watching Lou Dobbs, and I can watch him every night, and I can make that my ritual, and I can say yes, and I can go talk about him. I can talk about our society being an addict. I can talk about the normalization of depression and anxiety in our culture. I was reading in Newsweek the other day, and they were talking about men being depressed and what we need to do about that. I was reading an article the other day about people being overweight and reading about that. And you know what the answers are? Mm-hmm. A pill. Pharmaceutical. That's the answer. And they didn't talk about the illness of our culture. They didn't talk about the spiritual sickness of our culture. They didn't talk about the leaders saying, you have just told me a method and a way of helping families get healthier. The ill health manifested in our leadership by saying, we have to see how that affects the economy. That's sick. Mm-hmm. They didn't talk about that sickness. They didn't talk about what it meant in the formation of our nation. And one reason why our nation does have a chance for democracy. We're not functioning democracy, but one reason why we have a chance for a democracy is that when in the formation of our nation, they had town hall meetings. And in the town hall meetings, the local communities got together and met and choose a representative to send a representative because they didn't have the internet. Now that we have the internet, do we need representatives? That's another question. But anyway, okay, so we had a town hall meeting here, town hall meeting here, town hall meeting here. We had these voluntary associations that people joined and they belonged to and they had a voice and they sent their voice up in the air and they sent it out of the air. And you just could not come in and oppress these people because these people, the power was decentralized. It was the formation of our nation. Okay, now we're in a situation where that's changing. We have a chance for democracy. What I've noticed when it talks about depression and anxiety being normalized, when we're talking about the condition of what it means to be human and we see that we're out of whack, and I can see that I'm out of whack, and I think that supporting an industry and having an industry fulfill my needs so I can bring myself, I guess, out of whack, back into whack, you know, nobody's talking about that inner angst that I feel. And when I feel it, I don't know what to do with it. So I do something self-destructive. So I do something that I don't want to do to deal with that inner angst. Nobody's talking about that. Nobody's talking about we have an economic structure that we're not going to change, but we can see the problems that the economic structure creates. And we try to fit the fixes in the economic structure without changing the value system of the economic structure. We see that our economic structure creates an illness within us as human beings, but we try to fix it within the same economic structure that produced the illness. We see that our economic structure produces an environmental disasters. I mean, how disastrous can it be when you say, don't eat the fish because there's mercury in the fish? How disastrous can it be? It says, don't swim in here because it's polluted. How disastrous does it have to get when we talk about climate change and the disasters that are going to come out of climate change, and we put the fixes in the same economic structure, in the same political structure, which caused the problems in the first place. It's not going to work. Period. You cannot cure. Here I am, I'm struggling, I'm drinking whiskey, and I'm struggling drinking whiskey. Now I'm getting old enough, and whiskey's really becoming a problem, and I think, I can't drink whiskey anymore. It's just becoming a problem. So I think, oh, what am I going to do? Oh, I know. Marijuana, that's softer, that's easier, that's nicer. I think I'll go to marijuana. And I go to marijuana, and all of a sudden I realize people are getting arrested and put in jail for marijuana. I say, oh, I can't do the marijuana anymore. And I say, well, oh, I'll do some beer, and the beer will get me through. And I can't, and I'm compulsively with the beer, but I promised I wouldn't be compulsive with the beer, but you get compulsive with the beer as much as you were with the marijuana and the whiskey. And I say, well, that's not working. I say, I'll get religion. So I go and I get religion. Man, I show up every Sunday, every Wednesday night, every meeting, and I'm compulsive, and I'll get religion. Then my child looks at me and says, but Dad, you're still not at my ball games. But I got religion, and I got religion. But Daddy, so I don't get that. So I'll get in a recovery movement. I'm going to my 12-step groups. And my kid says to me, but Daddy, you're still not home. I said, that's okay, but I'm in recovery. So I can't. I'm trying to fit the fixes, and I'm trying to fix everything in the same addictive pattern, but I'm not changing the addictive pattern. It's the same thing our culture is doing when we pass legislation trying to fix the difficulties, but we don't change the economic pattern. So I can go to all these books and read all these books and preach on all these books and understand the pattern, but if I don't point to another process to deal with what's going on, I will have a good time being distracted from the real issue for the rest of my life. I'll enjoy identifying. God, yeah, look at this. Look at what these people are doing. Right now, we're working on an educational committee of the Democratic Club in Port St. Lucie. And in that club, you know, people were looking at Blackwater and privatization of our army. I mean, I don't know if you read that article recently, the parallel war that's going on in Iraq. It's just a recent article about that. We've been following that story. We've got 20 to 30,000 combatants that are private security forces in Iraq right now that they don't have to report on. They don't have to report the deaths. They don't have to report the cost. They don't have to report that. So there's this parallel army. All these fixes. All these attempts to correct what's wrong, but we're still addicts. So we need to ask ourselves, what's going on? How are we to understand this? And I don't know how many of you have ever worked on a project where you said you were going to do something, and somebody said, well, what is it we're going to do? And then somebody all of a sudden says, well, we have to know what the problem is and articulate the problem before we can really articulate the solution. And I can look at every one of these books and I can pull out a problem. I can read the Blackwater articles in a private and look at and pull out the problems. And I can develop a solution to that problem. And we can say, yeah, that's the solution. We need to get into subcommittees. We need to do this. We need to do these solutions. But I've got the wrong problem. That's not the problem. That's a symptom. It's not the problem. I need to be able to understand the problem. And the first thing I need to do is become intimate with my own inner world. Because my own inner world will reveal to me where the problems are. And when I say we've ended the war on the middle class and we're no longer an addict, and my stomach's still churning, I haven't dealt with the problem. I need to have the problem clearly articulated. And what has helped me, and in graduate school they call it, you got to have a problem statement before you begin exploring and writing about the solution. In order to get the problem statement, you got to have a description of what you're going to be talking about. It is absolutely essential that we get all this information and that we study all that information and that we understand it, because when we understand that, we get a bigger picture of what's going on, and we can bring a problem statement out of that recognizing that we can't rest in any one of those distractions and spend our life and spend our life energy on any one of those distractions and have a belief we're making real change. Because we won't be making real change. I'll be shifting from whiskey to marijuana to religion. But I won't really be changing. There's a difference between what we call first order change and second order change. First order change is when I shift from one addiction to the next addiction to the next addiction to the next addiction, wherever the compulsion's there, but my inner guts don't change. My overall sense of who I am does not change. The process in which I live does not change. But I'm changing all the time. But nothing's really changing. Everything's the same. First order change. We wrestle with each one of these problems and we fix it, and then another one comes up and we fix it, and another one comes up, and we spend our lives one after one political issue after another political issue, but nothing really changes. So a lot of conversation today about peak oil and how oil structures our economic system and how oil structures our lives. And when we talk about that, are we talking about first order change, second order change, which I'll get to in just a minute, but I've been practicing this exercise. If this energy and oil and fossil fuels are really a problem, how am I to understand they're a problem? How am I to get outside the problem? How am I to get outside that information to develop a problem statement so I can figure out maybe a possible solution? And I began to look around. What is in my life that structures my life, where I walk, where I talk, what I read, that has not evolved out of oil? The glasses I wear, the chairs I sit in, the paper I hold up, the cars I drive, the doorknob I open up, the toothbrush I use, the soap I use, the gardening tools I use, the fertilizers I buy to make my stuff grow in the garden. Everything I touch has a relationship to oil. Everything. It's unbelievable. Everything. How am I to understand how to deal with something when I'm thickly in it? How is that possible? So then I began imagining things. Well, what's not oil? So now all of a sudden, instead of screws holding wood together, I'm seeing plugs in my head. I said, I know that, the shakers. So I'm starting to pull things in my head. What about that? How do I get fertilizer that hasn't been oil? And then, and I'm thinking, okay, how do I get that? Because what happens is my imagination, my sense of self, who I am as a human being, when I'm born into this culture, the stage that I was born on to, what begun to wrap around me to structure who I am is also coated and soaked in oil. I was born into a house where my dad worked at the steel plant. You don't get much closer to oil than working at a steel plant. So his thinking as he was in the union, the strikes he went on, his thinking, labor against management and companies and all that kind of stuff, was also structured by oil. Who I am, how I think, is structured by fossil fuels. It's unbelievable. The tapestry of our society, the fabric of our culture, it's unbelievable. How am I to transform my imagination, my sense of self, outside of that, in order to get some hopeful, helpful evaluation of it? There's a school of thought when I was in seminary, they used to say it was Yale versus Chicago, and I'm really blue collar going up. When I heard that, I'm going, where in the world am I now? I had no idea what was going on. The Limbeckian school versus the pragmatic school. What am I doing with this? The basic premise from Yale was that you cannot escape your language system. You cannot escape your culture. You're in it. You can't get a read on it. You can't understand it. You're just in it. And back then, I'm going, well, is that a denial of evolution? Is there a moment in evolution where I can escape my language system? And I thought, that's pretty fundamentalist thinking, because that's a denial, and that's where I was with it, and that's how I fought them. So I started working on trying to understand how the brain works, because I've had to figure out how to argue with these guys. There needs to be a belief. I can be other than who I am. There needs to be a belief that our culture can be other than what it is. That's the starting point. The belief that it can be different. The belief that I can do something different. The belief that if I'm not involved in the local governmental decisions, we were talking earlier in the group that we had talking about post-traumatic stress syndrome prior, our 10 to 11 o'clock group, and somebody brought up, I don't know how the conversation got here, but it got there, somebody brought up housing for the poor. And I know from going to county commissioners' meetings and talking to county commissioners, when developers come in, you can put pressure upon them to put housing for people who don't make as much money as other people. Okay? But if I don't go there and I don't do that, I'm not participating in the meaning making on the local level. And when I don't participate in the meaning making at the local level, that means I'm not valuing the town hall meetings. If I'm not valuing the town hall meetings, that means I'm having some sense of hopelessness because I'm not participating in the meaning making of where I live, the structure of where I live. It gets quite depressing when you see Walmart, Home Depot, Sports Authority, Target, going up in your neighborhood where you used to see fields where you used to ride your bikes. But if I'm not participating in that decision-making process, I'm not participating in the meaning-making of it, which means I'm stuck in first-order change. I'm stuck in moving from one addiction to another addiction. I'm stuck in the belief that if I'm depressed, what's wrong with me will be fixed by a pill. I'm stuck in the belief I can't gain command of my own self. Somebody else has to do it for me. Second-order change is where we need to go. Second-order change is where we need to go. Second-order change is this, that we can create an economic system that has as its priority the well-being of what it means to be human and the environment, and that becomes the value system in which we try to deal with the problems that we have. First, second order change means that as I have been hurt in a relationship and I have promised myself never to get that close again, and I know every time I get that close, I end the relationship and break commitments. Second order change would be I'm committed that when I feel that movement in me that says run because I don't want to go there again, second order change says you plant your feet. And if you have to, hold your breath, but you don't move. Second order change. You don't move. You change the process. Second order change means if I'm struggling with whiskey and marijuana and religion, somewhere in my life, I plant my feet and the feelings that move me to shift to be compulsive, I find myself a community, a place to be where I can feel those feelings and say, who am I after I feel through these feelings? Who am I after I feel through these feelings? Who am I after on Tuesday night I turn the television off and I go to the county commissioners meetings for a year? Who am I after that? Who am I after I call these people up that are structuring my community and I go talk with them and I'm committed to do that for 2 years and I commit and I do that for 2 years. Who am I after that? Second order change. Second order change has within it the statement, who am I after I do what my whole being is telling me not to do? Who am I after? Not just the doing it, because the doing it is part of the transition to get to the afterward.
And I want to know who I am after that.
Who am I going to be when I shed in my imagination the normalness of functioning with the total structure of fossil fuel? What in the world does that mean?
That means that I start putting images in my head of furniture with pigs in it.
That means that I start figuring out where I can go to get manure for my garden. And I start putting those processes in my head that are closer to the earth. That when I go outside, I feel the dirt.
Who am I after I change these patterns? Who am I after I work so these changes are normalized? Who am I after now that I feel anxious, I sit down and I breathe deeply and I work through that anxiety?
Who am I after I share with somebody or I share with a group of people I can trust those things that I swore to myself I would never share? And I know that I've structured my life in such a way that the sole purpose of my life is never sharing these things that have happened to me. So I only pick people to put in my life that don't ask such questions. So I never go to groups and meetings that talk about these things.
Who am I after I begin to make these changes? That's what they taught us in seminary. Everybody who had children when you first went to seminary, they said to them, when your child interrupts you, because your child is going to interrupt you, it's not an interruption, it's an opportunity. So somehow that was an opportunity.
She made something beautiful that she shares today.
On Father's Day. See how that is? Okay. That is where we need to go. Who am I after I begin to restructure my imagination so that when I think instead of when I hear that senator say after we see how that might affect the economy and I feel hopeless and I say things are going to go as they normally go. Who am I after I call the professor that was talking about the changes we need to make in New York, at the University of New York? Who am I after I call her and ask her to come down here and talk to us as a community and tell us what she means and what she understands the changes we need to make and begin to implement those changes in this church and in that community? Who am I after that? That's second order change. And we need to begin to process second-order change and what that means and have that in us. We need to know the difference between content and process. We need to know the difference between first-order change and second-order change. We need to know the difference because if we don't, I will continually be distracted by this information that I need to know but not recognize these are just pieces to the puzzle. There's no ends over there. Who am I after? I begin to value myself above any economic principles. Who am I after? I begin to value myself above sacrificing myself in relationship because I'm fearful I'll lose the relationship. Who am I after? I begin to value what's going on in my house and the health of my house. After I recognize I'm living in a value system that devalues the health of my house. Who am I after I start to engage a community and start to participate in the meaning-making process? That's the question we need to wrestle with. Who am I after I step out of how I have been living and the culture that I have been enculturated with? And begin to look at it at a distance. Who am I after that?